Welcome back. If you aren't already following Naked, please take a minute to do so you don't miss out on any future episodes. Each follow means so much and it actually helps a lot. If you have more than just a minute, it would be absolutely incredible if you could leave a review and maybe even share an episode with a friend. I'm relatively new to the pod world, especially new to the things that are important in the podcasting world. And apparently reviews and follows are up there on the list of importance. So I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Welcome to Naked, where stories unfold. I'm your host, Janelle, a once former pastor's wife who exchanged small town living for a nomadic life. The unexpected change in our life led my husband and our four kids to traveling the world. From years of being rooted in our small town to the thrill of wandering the world, our story has been anything but ordinary. On our journeys, we've met amazing people, learned their way of life, and heard their unique stories, which has led me to understand the profound impact of shared experiences. In each episode, we explore moments of transformation, guided by one single question: is there a time in your life when everything changed? We invite ordinary storytellers like yourself to share the often unexpected turns in life. So grab a seat and settle in. This is the Naked Podcast. While we've been traveling, we've found so many unique groups that offer a place for people to connect and just kind of get to know each other. And this summer, I decided I wanted to read more books. So I thought, what a good idea to do is to join a little book club to get me in a momentum of reading and connection to people who are like-minded. So I decided to take a stroll across Barcelona, which is like an hour walk, and I found this group of people that were reading under this beautiful tree, and I joined them. And we did about an hour of reading together, and then at the end of that, we connected through sharing why we are reading the book, what it's meant to us, and maybe our favorite authors that have kind of intrigued us in this season of our lives. And this is a favorite part because you really get to know people and connect people, hear where they're from, and learn a little bit about why they're reading what they're reading and what they're kind of learning from that. Across from me was this beautiful lady from Scotland, and we really connected, I think, off the top because I had just visited Glasgow. Our family had spent 5 months in Glasgow, and that was her home city. And so that just gave us some grounds to kind of connect on. And through that, our conversation led us to, hey, would you like to be on the podcast? To which she answered, yes, I would be delighted to. And of course, I'm so honored that she said yes. And our conversation was so beautiful. Ruth shared her story with such honesty and rawness. And I know that you'll enjoy this episode and find comfort in her story. Thanks for being here. Well, thank you, those who are here listening to Naked and joining us once again. I am delighted to have another guest. One thing about traveling is the beautiful part of it is meeting a really amazing, unique people. And a few weeks back, we were in Barcelona and I heard about this meetup idea. And I was like really craving to connect with some people and just do something maybe outside of the realm of just our family. So I found this like book club, and my son and I went on a bit of a journey, went to this book club and found this group of people sitting nestled under a tree near the zoo in Barcelona, and just started chatting. And we read books for like an hour. And then at the end, we kind of connected and chatted a bit. And you and I just, when I first heard you talking, I was like, oh my gosh, like, I feel like I want to hear more about your story and hear more about you. And you're traveling and you're in Barcelona for a while. And I was like, oh, I'm just so intrigued. And I believe you're from Scotland. Right?
That's right.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. And so we had just come from Scotland. And so I was like, oh, like, I'm just all just drawn to, honestly, the accent. Oh my goodness. it's just amazing. And just the culture of Scotland always just felt like a bit of like home to us. I don't know if it's partly just the weather in some ways can mirror some of our Canadian weather. But yeah. And so we went out chatting, and then it all kind of just was like, would you want to be on the podcast? After talking to you for just a few minutes, you're like, yeah, I would. And so it's taken us a bit to connect, but I'm so glad that we're here. So my guest today is Ruth, and we get to just hang out and really get to know each other better, which I'm really grateful and honored to have you here. So thank you.
Janelle, as you're saying that, I mean, I think you're the first American abroad that I've met that's actually lived in Glasgow. So I think that was the point of connection when you said, oh yeah, we've just come from Glasgow, which is where we were living for a while. I was like, okay, most Americans, and in fact, most visitors tend to kind of end up in Edinburgh. So that in itself, Glasgow is my home city. Well, there's a bit of a chip on our shoulders, but not being quite as beautiful as Edinburgh. So the fact that you'd actually chosen to make Glasgow your home, I kind of immediately kind of made me warm to you, think, oh yeah, this is a woman with kind of good taste. So.
Oh, well, I really, really appreciate you being here. Before we launch into it, maybe you can tell people a little bit about yourself, where you currently are, just to give our listeners a little bit of a knowing of who they're listening to.
So as we've established, I'm originally from Glasgow. I did spend a lot of time in London, which I think is the reason that my accent's not maybe quite as strong as it might be. I'm currently in quite a sort of humid and warm Barcelona for the summer. I'm taking a sabbatical from work, and I will unfortunately be returning to Glasgow in the fall, where I'm picking back my work up in October. But I'm here basically to learn Spanish, enjoy some of the kind of Barcelona culture, and just kind of have a break from work and a break from life. So,
wow! And how long are you in Barcelona?
So I arrived on the 1st of June, and I leave at the very end of September. But I'm going via Sicily. I've got a wedding in Sicily in October, so I'm nice. Doing that on my way back to Glasgow. So nice. Hopefully that'll kind of sweeten the pill a bit, because I think going straight back to Glasgow will be tricky. So this is a kind of a bit of a bribe to get myself back into real life.
Yeah, especially like the weather. I mean, we went to Glasgow last year in October, and it was beautiful in October, but when the tail end of November came, it was like, oh my goodness, it's different. It's cold in a way that I don't experience in Northern Alberta, which is where I'm from. And it's a kind of cold that's very damp. It's very Vancouver damp.
It gets into your bones. And I think actually you get colder with that damp cold than if you were in the kind of the dry. The same is true like humidity, right? You can never quite get cool in a humid heat. I think if you've got kind of dry heat or cold, you can kind of balance out a bit more. But yeah, I know the winters are brutal. So
you're heading back that way. So what do you do in Glasgow? What's your work?
So I work in the university sector. I guess I've had probably quite a long kind of relationship with sort of higher education. My father was a university professor at the University of Glasgow. His area was psychology. I then ended up in a series of sort of media jobs in London, and then decided for some reason to go back and do a doctorate. But that was in film studies. Although it was a reasonable amount of kind of like pop psychology. So I always felt that my father's influence has kind of worked its way out somehow. And I did a series of kind of communications jobs in the university sector. And then eventually when my father fell ill, I was able to kind of use that kind of background in communications to get a job in Glasgow. So I now work in a university in Glasgow doing communications for a law school. So I kind of feel I'm still using the words, you know, like, if nothing else, a doctor gives you the ability to kind of like consume a lot of information and write well. And I guess that's where that kind of comes in. But the job I do is quite kind of fun. Like, I am involved in doing a podcast, but behind the scenes, I do kind of like videos. It's quite, communications is a very kind of broad church. So there's never a boring day, and you're always learning something new. So, yeah.
Wow. That sounds really interesting. Yeah. Not what I was thinking when you're like, I work in the university. That sounds like it's got a bunch of beautiful branches that you can kind of.
Yes. Yeah. And also it goes without saying you're surrounded by like sort of smart, interesting people who are motivated by something that's not kind of commercial. So, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that academics are badly paid, but like they're not in it for the money. So you tend to find that you're hanging out with people that have like lots of interesting ideas and are generally interested in sort of, you know, ideas and concepts, and they're usually quite good fun. I always sort of say I worked in a medical school, and then I worked in a sort of engineering department. Lawyers are definitely the most fun down the pub, so they've got the best chance. So. And I also, I mean, I came from the humanities, so I always feel like law is the kind of the hard edge of the humanities. So some of the work that we do in the school, actually, you can sort of see is moving into things like philosophy, sort of like some kind of like, you know, business principles. So there's kind of a, I always sort of feel that subject areas are kind of like artificial distinctions, and you see that in terms of the cross collaborations we have with academics in other parts of the university. And that's kind of interesting as well, just seeing where the kind of connections are.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's amazing. that's the cool thing about traveling. I'm sure you're finding being in Barcelona too. Like, there's such a mix. I found being there, such a mix of people from all over the world that, you know, find themselves in these unique spaces where we're all kind of together, all of us a little bit lost in our own, you know, in this new place. Yeah. And you just meet the coolest people. And
everyone with different reasons for being here, whether or not it's like the job of a lifetime or like to get away from, you know, the worst job ever. You know, kind of people that are having like big transitions in their lives, like, yeah. And you realize actually that no one has a boring story. It's just having the time and the space to really kind of like scratch the surface and get to know someone's story. I mean, even within the law, even within the sort of Spanish language school that I'm going to, there's some people that are passing through for a week. There's other people that are there for a year, and they've all got different reasons for being there, and they've all got their different perspectives in the world. And yeah, you're meeting so many people, and it's for me as a kind of an extrovert, like that's great. That's like, you know, my happy place.
Have you found it easy to connect with people?
I had. So this was a conversation I was having with another classmate today. Yes and no. So this classmate, she's from the UK as well. She's here until next February. And we were talking about that kind of, particularly within a kind of a language school, the churn. So I was having lunch with a few friends last week, and I said something about something that happened in class maybe 3 weeks before. And I looked around and I realized that no one in like around the table had been in the class at the time. And 3 weeks, right? So this churn is really kind of quite kind of relentless. And it's hard, like, you know, you meet people for 3 or 4 weeks, you really like them. Saying goodbye is hard, and then you're meeting a series of new people. And for me, and I haven't worked it out yet, I've been here now for 6 weeks. For me, it's trying to make connections with people that are maybe in the city a bit longer. I mean, they might feel the same about me. They're like, well, you're here for 4 months. Why do I want to make friends with you? But I'm finding that maybe some of the connections, like the meetup where we met, that's a broader mix of people. Some people are here for a job. You know, I've met a few people that have been here for 5 or 6 years. And then you're getting, you might see these people again over a series of months. So I think in terms of those sort of, I don't like to use the word superficial, but let's say in terms of those early connections, absolutely. I think the challenge might be is how you deepen them. The problem then, of course, is going to be it'll hit the end of September, and then it'll be devastating to leave them as well. So, but you can, I suppose you can't avoid saying goodbyes in life. So it is what it is.
Yeah. I think traveling teaches you that very well, like to get comfortable with goodbyes.
Yes.
And knowing that a goodbye means that there's another hello. We always think of that as a family, like, and it's just friends that you just didn't know that you could have. I think now we went back to Glasgow, was our very first, our very first place was actually Edinburgh, where we stayed the very first time in 2018. And we met somebody, met this couple actually at a restaurant on a like small little town. Our daughters went to the loo and they ended up chatting in the washroom and becoming friends. And eventually by the end of that conversation, we were exchanging numbers, and we went to her house for dinner, and we went to her birthday party. And it was one of the reasons we actually wanted to come back to Scotland, is because we had created this conversation and this connection with somebody randomly in the loo, you know. It's just like, and we're still friends. We've stayed connected throughout the last 6.5 years. And so it's kind of cool that some people, it might be a short stint of like, you know, it's not a deep relationship, but then there's others that just, they stick, and it doesn't matter. Distance doesn't.
And it sounds like you feel like a native when you said you went to the loo. It's like, this is someone that's lived in the UK. It's a very British saying, isn't it?
it is. I had to learn that the first time, because it was like every place refers to it differently, right? It's the toilet, it's the washroom.
It's something you want to get right.
It is. People are like, the what room? The washroom? What? Yeah. So I think that's the cool thing about it. It can be hard for sure. I think when we started traveling, we're like, oh, we would just have such almost devastated when you would leave. You kind of connect with people. There's a lot of tears, but we've gotten comfortable with like, that's okay. That's part of kind of like life, is there's a lot of goodbyes, but there's also a lot of hellos. Yep. So it's kind of the uniqueness part of the journey. But before we get going, what are you drinking today?
Good question. So I was actually quite excited. This is one of my favorite teas in Scotland. So I've got my mug to the side of me. I haven't taken it yet, because it does need like a reasonable amount of time to stew. It's Yogi tea, and it's licorice. Now, I hate licorice in its kind of like sort of sweet form, but licorice tea is amazing. So, and the great thing is they have these kind of slightly weird quotes as part of the tea bag. So this is, don't wait for heaven to come to you, create heaven. So how's that?
Wow.
This is great. So I was first introduced to this tea by my PhD supervisor, who would always sort of furnish me with some cup of something before she kind of started the onslaught against what paper I'd written that day. And this was one of the teas that I liked the best. So I haven't been able to find it for a while in the UK, so I was really surprised to find it in Barcelona. But I was in like a Whole Foods store, and there's a whole kind of like range of that brand, and I immediately saw it. And it seems weird, but actually drinking hot tea when it's hot does cool you down. I don't know how it works, but it does actually help. So I've got water as well, but I've got the tea. So I'm hoping the next few minutes will be sweet enough, because it's really quite sweet once it's stewed. I'm all being
so what's the brand of it? What's the name?
It's Yogi Tea.
Yogi Tea. I think I've seen it.
And they have all kinds of different sort of ranges. But to be honest, I like the tea so much, I can't be bothered trying any of the other ones. You know, like if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So yeah, so that's my go-to. Your tea.
And what's the like if I'm going to go look for it, because we're in England right now, what would I be looking for as far as the type of the flavor, I guess?
I can just sort of... So it's licorice.
Okay, it's just called licorice. Okay.
Licorice, yeah. But it's like an orange box. No, it's really, right. Yeah, that's been sort of like left for 10 minutes, and that's now like, it's quite sweet with a bit of a kind of orange peely. It's quite, she says in July, it's quite Christmassy.
Perfect. Sometimes you just need a little Christmas in July.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever time of year it is.
Yeah, exactly. I found this really great little bakery called Oz. I don't know if you've seen it or been to it.
Not yet.
Oh, check it out. They have really, really, really good, well, everything. Their sandwiches, their cinnamon buns are amazing. Okay. But they, their chai is amazing. I don't know if you like chai, but I really, really like.
Very much so. Yep.
Okay. Yep. So there's a company actually in Barcelona. It's a husband and wife couple, from what I understand, from a little Google search that I did. And they started making their own chai. It's very like, it's just condensed, basically spices, but it doesn't have like any sweeteners and stuff in it. It's really condensed. Mm-hmm. And you just add like a bit of it to your steamed almond milk or whatever. And so they serve it there, but you can actually buy your own bottle of it. So I bought some before I left so I can make my own as I travel.
Okay.
And it's just called chai, C-H-Y. So if you go there, I highly recommend
it. And it's a little taste from Barcelona as well, just to kind of connect you with the city.
Yeah. I like if I could just keep an ongoing supply of it, I would have it all the time.
Maybe but get it shipped to you. I don't know.
Yeah, I know. They're going to be on the podcast, so I'm going to learn more about that.
Okay.
Yeah. So in the future, I'm sure I'll be able to find it if we can ship it worldwide and all the listeners can get it. But it's very, very good. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here. I really, really appreciate every time someone says yes. I feel a huge sense of honor, because I know that sometimes sharing our stories, the first time I shared my story on the podcast, I was like sweating and profusely. And I just was, it just can feel like a lot to let people into a part of you that maybe people don't, you wouldn't often share.
Yep.
But I've learned through doing that is that it just creates this connection with people, and it spreads a lot of light to people who might be sitting in a bit of darkness and wondering how they're going to get out of their own journey. Yep. And how is there hope for their story? So that's why we're here. And that's why I feel so honored when people say yes, because I'm like, oh, this is just a little more light in the world to spread. So the question I always ask is there a time that when you think about it right now, and I know it's hard not to pre-think about things. I know when I was doing my recording, my mind was going to all the things, like which branch. But when you sit here right now, is there something that comes to mind when you're like, yeah, this is the time when everything changed for me?
Yeah, for sure. And I've had bereavements in my life, but when you asked me that question and when you pitched the podcast to me, first thing that goes to is the loss of my mother. So my mum died quite suddenly at the start of 2022, and I'd say really I've only kind of come out under the shadow of that in the last kind of like sort of half year, 12 months. Wow. So it really, on a kind of emotional but also kind of a practical level, it just completely sort of flipped my world upside down, for sure. Yeah.
Wow. So this was like a sudden, your mum's loss was a...
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, in hindsight, I've got kind of my own kind of views on kind of how the pandemic kind of has affected us as a sort of the world. And I know that people have been affected in different ways, but I really feel that kind of going in to the start of 2022, there was not much gas in the tank, certainly for myself and those around me. So I think when I lost my mum unexpectedly, I was already kind of like, as I say, the resilience battery was kind of low. And I think also my mum and I had sort of really, we'd deepened our relationship over the pandemic. So just to sort of dial back, I mentioned my sort of father in passing. We lost dad in 2016. So I'm an only child, unmarried. My mum and I are very close. I came back to Glasgow when my father was very ill. We knew that he was on borrowed time. Moving back to Glasgow, being back in my home city, was the best thing I ever did. But we had quite a sort of difficult sort of number of years. So he passed away in 2016. His sister, my sort of favorite auntie and godmother, she was then diagnosed with terminal cancer. She passed in 2018. At the same time, on my mother's side, her sister was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's in her early 60s. So there was just one thing after another. And I remember, and this is, you know, never tempt fate, at the close of 2019, turning to a friend saying, I really feel like we're turning a corner and life is getting easier. And that just shows you how long we'd had this kind of stress. Wow. Then obviously COVID happened. And again, January 2022, we were kind of coming out of it. I can't remember what variant it was, it was like Delta variant. I really was feeling kind of a bit more optimistic. This is our year. And then my mum had a massive stroke. I was due to go to hers for dinner. So we had this kind of like routine during COVID where so she lived in a sort of similar part of town to me. So just the university area in Glasgow. And over COVID, just because we were both on our own, we kind of bubbled. I don't know if this was happening in the US, totally. But we kind of formed a bubble. So we'd have like three nights where I'd sort of stay over. So we kind of were like, right, 6 days out of seven, we're going to see someone else. Because at that point, like, you're not going to see anyone else. So we'd really sort of, we kept that up, even as the kind of the restrictions had loosened, we'd sort of kept up that kind of connection. So I'd seen her the night before. I think the last thing we did as a sort of shared activity was she helped me take my Christmas tree down. Okay. And we'd sort of texted each other kind of good night. I think she'd been watching Matthew Bourne's Sleeping Beauty. Anyway, we'd had a really nice, low-key, lovely day together, which I'm really happy that we had. And the following day, I was due to go to hers for dinner. She wasn't responding to her texts. I got a text from a friend of hers who was worried because she hadn't shown up for a walk. As fortune would have it, my friend was coming over. So we basically walked over to my mum's house. And that was when, you know, I opened the door and I found my mum. And the sort of the next bit was very, very kind of like strong in mind. My friend was calling the ambulance. I was doing CPR. I'd only learned it the November before. It was one of those things for 20 years, I kept thinking I really need to my first aid course. And then somehow, I don't know if you call it fate or whatever, but I knew what to do, right? So, and I still remember, I mean, it sounds ridiculous. I remember having this ridiculously warm coat on with my scarf and I was like, I don't want to stop, so keep going. I remember at one point, you know, hearing, so they say when you're kind of like, you're doing your kind of like CPR, keep going, like, even if you do it with a lot of force, you risk cracking like a rib. That sounds kind of brutal, but you're better, like, do you want to save someone's life or you know? And I remember the sound as I basically cracked my mother's rib. And then I heard the buzz of the buzzer at the front door and the ambulance drivers came in. As soon as they turned in the door, I could see it was just like she was gone. And I think they would be able to tell that she had passed some hours before. So this was kind of what maybe like sort of early evening on the Monday. And I think, so later that evening, I was in her bedroom and I sat down on her bed and I could feel it was warm and it was her electric blanket. So I think she'd been getting ready for bed the night before and she'd maybe just been sort of, she was a night owl. So I think she was probably like, she'd had her dinner. She was like, you know, probably sometime after midnight. And I think she was getting ready for bed and she was basically, she had a massive stroke. And in a way, that is a relief because I think it was like she never saw it coming. It's interesting. So I was the one doing all the phone calls to sort of, you know, my mother had so many friends, so many connections, so many classes. And it's interesting, you get a sense of, I mean, I know we talk about holding space for something like this podcast, holding space when you're delivering news of a bereavement. Even when it's your mother, you're holding space for someone else in that moment of shock. And you, the people that were shocked, and then the older, sounds terrible, those that were kind of older. So my mother was only 74 when she died, but she had friends that were in her 80s. And the more elderly or senior friends that I spoke to, they were like, that was a good death. And it becomes... they move away from their shock, maybe because they are more acquainted with death, they have more peers that they've lost, they're maybe the last of their friendship group. they see that actually not having a long drawn out illness, which I saw with my father, actually is a blessing. And it's very hard to see past your immediate grief. But as time has gone on, like my mother was an incredibly active woman. And I think, as someone said, look, you wouldn't have wanted her to have had a massive stroke and then been unable to kind of like function. So it was absolutely wrenching for me. But I think for the kind of mother, the kind of person my mother was, I think it was probably as good a, you know, an ending as, I mean, everyone wants to die in their sleep when they're 100 and sort of, you know, but I think as these things go, it was a blessing, let's say. But very hard to be the ones left behind.
And be the only one. It sounds like you're an only child.
And it's an interesting one because, I mean, so my mother was the eldest of 8. My father was the eldest of 4. I have a lot of family, like, and, you know, and the older I get, the more I really appreciate my family. And you know, some of them are in very distant places. Some of them are around the corner. But it's different, I think, not having siblings, not having people that have those shared memories. So even like kind of vacations, even sort of like kind of childhood home, there's something that like you lose. And the other thing is also, and I think this is something that I didn't really appreciate, is losing the second parent's not like losing the first parent again. It's more than the sum of its parts, because you're sort of losing your connection to your the parent that's already passed away. So I felt that my mum was a kind of like kind of a repository of shared memories about my father. So when I lost my mother, I felt I lost my father again. And I think the other thing was, and this is just when we're talking about practicalities as well as sort of emotional kind of difficulties, all the decisions stop with you. People can volunteer to help, and you discover people always say, what can I do to help? Which is beautifully meant, but frankly very unhelpful, because when you're like looking down the barrel of like grief, you actually want someone to say, do you know what, I'm going to turn up today and I'm going to bring you food. Or you say you need a lift to kind of, you know, pick something up. I'm going to, you know, you don't have the bandwidth to really think about what you need. Someone else has to say, I can do this for you, yes or no. And then that becomes a more kind of tangible kind of offer of help. But there's some things that other people can't decide. So, you know, and frankly, I would want people to sort of decide. So, you know, what kind of, you know, music do you want for your mother's funeral? You know, I don't know, really kind of small things like, you know, the undertaker says, do you want the wedding ring back? You know, all these things that are, every single decision is emotionally wrought, and yet you can't pass it to someone else. And this sort of decision-making process has kind of continued quite a long time, because we had the family house to decide what to do with, right? And I do know that some family members felt I should have sold it, but, you know, so I have this kind of like 3-bedroom sort of like townhouse flat in the West End of Glasgow. You know, do I sell it? Well, that's a wrench. Do I move into it? Well, why do I need a 3-bedroom flat? You know, it's too big for one person. My mum feels to be, you know, do I rent it? So this, believe it or not, that decision just about what to do, that took the best part of a year. And then there's the clearing it. So again, you know, a lifetime's worth. My parents, I think, had been in that flat apartment for 30 years. Okay.
Wow.
So my mother wasn't a hoarder, but like, you don't get rid of things when you don't need to. It's like having, you know, it's like having a big handbag or a spare room. Things get put in it, and if you're not forced to really kind of clear it out, you don't. So that actually, to be honest, I mean, we're now in time recording, July. I didn't finish clearing the house until the end of April this year. Wow. So that's 2 years after my mum died. And that's 2 years of having either weekends that are attributed to clearing stuff out, or times that you're not doing, you're feeling guilty but not doing it. So it's always kind of in the background. And every single decision that you make has an emotional kind of, you know, kind of resonance, or you don't know what you're going to find that day. So I'd kind of go in on a random Sunday and think, right, I'm just going to, I don't know. You know, if you're going to do clothes, it's going to be hellish. You know, it's going to be upsetting. Yeah. But then you find something you think is going to be like paperwork, and then you discover something like, my mum wrote poetry, and I found poems that she'd written about how much she missed her father, and quite recently, so kind of like in the latter 6 months before she passed, And that wasn't something that she talked about a huge amount. Hmm. So she had these feelings that, you know, she maybe didn't want to burden me with. And that was upsetting to relive my mother's grief and not feel that I'd been able to kind of help her. That house of kind of, I think they call it, is it in Scandinavia, they do kind of like death clearing. Mm-hmm. That's a great idea. And when I'm being slightly more, the other thing is your sense of humour becomes more black. I mean, Glaswegians tend to have quite a kind of robust sense of humour anyway, but my sense of humour has definitely got darker. And I think I've turned around to at least one uncle or kind of, you know, older relative and just say, like, you better start the death clearing now, because do you really want your daughter, son, to have to deal with that when you're gone? And, you know, I'm hoping that they live till they're 100, but, you know, just being kind of cognizant of this is something that really every family member is going to have to deal with. And, yeah,
right.
And it even makes me think, you've got, you know, someone one day is going to have to clear up my house. What kind of crap, pardon my French, do I want to leave them to have to kind of go through? But I don't. Yeah. So start decluttering now.
Yeah, clearing the space. Now that you're on the other end and you understand what that looks like, and parting with something, it's like emotional attachment to everything, right? Because it, a lot of, even if it's your own things, you have this, well, even more so this attachment to something. With traveling, every time we go back to Canada, we go through all of our boxes and decide to like purge and get down. And every time we go back, it's, you know, you get rid of half of what you had, because you're like, I just don't, this doesn't actually hold any significant value. It's just holding up space, you know. And I heard someone once say that clutter in your home was clutter in your mind. And, you know, it's just like clear the clutter so you don't have it. But it's hard.
Speaking of kind of, you know, so meeting people that are kind of in transit and, you know, kind of coming to Barcelona, I had this kind of quite, you know, involved conversation yesterday evening with a couple of people they're both from the US, and they separately had these kind of like storage containers for a number of years, where the monthly rentals just sort of ticking by, but the kind of the emotional kind of like of actually going through and like clearing through things. And that's just things that you own. It's not even, I think there's a particular kind of resonance with possessions that you've maybe sort of seen in your family. Like, you know, we had this sort of frankly quite ugly kind of like Welsh dresser in our living room, which for a brief heartbeat I thought, should I keep? And I was like, no, and I've never liked it. But because it was a kind of a backdrop to my childhood, you start having kind of like sort of second thoughts. I'm in Barcelona, I'm like renting a room in an apartment. I've got a one bedroom apartment back at home, which unfortunately now has the things that I couldn't bear to part with, you know, from my parents' house. And it is mainly things like, you know, photograph albums. The books aren't such a big thing. I did take, my father had this kind of like large kind of sort of quite comfortable kind of chair. That is an addition that I'm quite happy with, because that is a kind of something that does connect me with my father. My mum, as well as being a poet, loved painting. So I have huge numbers of her paintings, many of which have been promised to people and I can't remember whom. You know, so those are the things that really actually do have resonance with them as people, rather than just being things that happened to be in their house while they were alive. Yeah. But I know that I'm going to go back. I mean, I'm in a one-bedroom apartment. Okay, I'm buying books like they're going out of fashion, and I've got clothes. And actually, there's not a huge amount else that I need. You know, okay, it's a furnished flat. I've got kind of a nice kind of like, you know, kitchen sort of utensils and so on. But it does make you think about how little you really need. And I'm sure you probably find this as well, being on the road for so long, how little you really need to function, and also even to kind of feel connected and to make a space feel like home. So I'm hoping that when I go back in October, the autumn plan will be just to kind of completely like slash and burn all my possessions. Unfortunately, I've got a feeling I'll probably slump into depression at the eternal winter that I'm looking down the barrel. But as you say, kind of, I think that kind of was it clutter in the house, clutter in the mind. Absolutely. That definitely kind of resonates with me. So good intentions.
And it's so hard to like, to part. It's so hard. Can be like such a hard thing to do. I remember listening to this couple of guys. They started this minimalist lifestyle, basically, where I think actually what happened was his mom passed away. And same thing, he was like going under her bed and pulling out all these like Rubbermaid containers full of pictures and cards and stuff. And he's like, what is all of this? What is all of this stuff? Like, I feel obligated to keep it. So he put all of it into storage because he felt so bad about like getting rid of it. Yeah. And he said, later I realized I had the storage container that I was paying money for to house things that had no connection to me, really, like heart connection, but I felt obligated to have it. So he's like, why don't I just take photos of everything, put it on a hard drive, and at least if I ever want to, some point in my life, go look at these things, I can have them, but they're not holding up like a huge storage container full of things that I'm probably likely never going to look at. What started this idea of like, why don't we live like this?
And actually, you could probably take those photographs and then just delete 90% of them, and you'd then have a number that you might actually be able to engage with. I mean, something that happened, it was one of those sort of strange periods. I think after Mum passed away, her car kept breaking down. But again, I really struggled to get rid of that. So I had a year where I was doing battle with this kind of like old car, which I think it had what they kind of call like a parasitic drain. So basically, it was 50-50 every time I started the car, whether or not it would actually, like, the battery would turn over.
Oh.
And I told myself I was hanging on to it because I'm what I call, kind of call a reluctant driver. You probably find in Glasgow, if you're living in kind of quite an urban area, you actually don't need a car, which I know in some parts of the US or Canada, that's like kind of, you know, crazy. But I kept the car and I sort of told myself it was really because I needed to keep my hand in with the driving. But I think more than that, it was an emotional connection to my mum. So when we'd had over COVID, when we had sort of, you know, things that loosened up a bit, we took a lot of kind of what we call, they weren't staycations because we did actually like leave town, but mm-hmm. we did like all kinds of sort of parts of Scotland that we'd never done, and we'd never really kind of holidayed that much together. So we went to kind of the Highlands, we went to sort of like up to sort cool. of the west, northwest of Scotland, we went down to the south. We had a run of, I say good weather, like the sun came out, right? So you maybe, I think we topped 26 degrees, but we just got this run, and every time I came back from work, I was like, yeah, we had another week off and the weather was amazing. And I think, again, one of those things in hindsight, I'm really glad that we took that time to kind of go away, and we took that time and we were lucky with the weather. But a very important part of that was the car, right? So when Mum died, like, you know, we still had all the CDs that were kind of sort of stashed in the kind of the sides, the sort of side drawers of the car, which had been like my mum's choice, my choice, and really reminded me of those road trips. And I think that was the real reason that I struggled to get rid of the car. But the other thing was, in addition to the car breaking down, my phone died a couple of weeks after my mom passed away, and it had all of the photographs I had, both of trips that I'd sort of taken to like Southeast Asia and also all the trips with my mother. And I went into the phone store, and it was a kind of young girl who was obviously, it was probably her Saturday job. And when she said the immortal words, yeah, the motherboard is gone, I was just like, woo! And it was gone, and there's nothing we could do. And I felt awful. I mean, it was just, you know, just one other thing to kind of feel kind of terrible about. Yeah. But in the end, I asked various sort of family and friends if they had any pictures of my mum they'd taken recently, particularly for, like, you know, at the funeral, I wanted to have a kind of a sort of a notice board of pictures of mum sort of different times. And I realised, like, in the end, I had too many to choose from. I had a board that probably had about 25, 30 pictures from her life. I had pictures that, you know, friends had sent me. I had pictures on my mum's phone. I had pictures turned out on my computer. It was more than enough pictures to print up and have around. And I realised that actually I didn't need the pictures on the phone. It was hard to let go of, and it wasn't something that I chose to do. But ultimately, the pictures that I had were more than enough.
Right.
You know, I only have space on my... So I have a piano, which I call my occasional table because I never actually play it. I've got a mantelpiece, I've got a piano. I've probably only got space for about 8 pictures that are out at any one time.
Right.
How many do you need? I mean, you carry the memory of your person, like your loved one, in your heart anyway. Right. And I've never been one really for photographs. And it made me realize that I needed a lot less than I thought I did. So once you get past that kind of the wrench of it, something being taken away from you, you realize, actually, I don't need this. And I think that's probably true with things like clothes. So I really kind of cut down, like, I think going through a loved one's clothing is one of the hardest things. And I remember actually, and this was about a year after my mom passed, I went through, she had a kind of a winter coat she was wearing, and taking things out, and I found things that I remember having on the last day that I saw her. So it was things like, I found like a shopping receipt for the last trip to the grocery store that she'd done just after we'd said goodbye. I found, it was a little kind of handkerchief with, she had vitamin pills. And I remember we'd had brunch that morning with a friend, and I think we were in a hurry to go out for a walk. So she just basically sort of, totally the kind of thing that I would do as well. She basically just sort of stuck the pills. It was like, you know, kind of like cod liver ones in a little handkerchief, stuck it in her pocket with a view to take it later. And such a kind of human detail. That was really very upsetting as well, because it was sort of snapshot in time. But once I'd sort of allowed myself to feel those emotions and I put everything to a side, the coats then was kind of neither here nor there. Like once the coat was just kind of no longer my mum's possession,
right.
Well, actually, that could go. And in the end, most of my mother's clothing did go to charity shops. And then you feel, well, actually, it'll have another life and it'll be able to kind of like clothe someone else. And that's where you try and get, if you're going to be kind of a bit more kind of, I'm not going to say woo-woo, but a bit more kind of spiritual, you think, actually, if you let go of something, it can be used by someone else for something else. And that's quite powerful.
Yeah. Realizing that, like, it can almost have like a rebirth in a sense, like a, you know, somebody else like feeling at home.
And actually that was the case with the car. So having done battle for about a year, I had a flat tire. One of those things that happened to be, it was when I was pulling into a garage, the guy knew someone behind the counter. You know, the Glasgow culture is like, oh, I know, I've got a friend down the road. He called his mate, who was a mechanic. He fixed the tire, and I was basically bitching about how much I hated the car. And he said, look, if you ever want to sell it, anyway, long story short, the story went that he had a client who, so not to give Glasgow a bad reputation, but there's a tendency for catalytic converters on cars to get clipped, like basically stolen. Wow. So people just, they don't steal the car, they just steal the catalytic converter because it's easy to kind of like, sort of basically kind of click it and steal it. Yeah. So her car was basically a write-off. And I think she had like sort of two young kids, one had additional support needs. She couldn't afford, so my mum had an automatic because we bought it from an American colleague of my father's, where obviously automatic cars are the norm.
Yeah.
So she basically was struggling to sort of finance another automatic car. And he said, you know, if you want to get rid of it at some point, I've got a home for it. But 4 weeks later, I rang him back. So for me, that was kind of, I felt my mum would have been happy with that. Like the car was going. And I think he promised, I said, look, you know, this is the background. I'm selling it to you. You know, I can't get the car to start. If you can work out where the problem is, you know, in good conscience, you know exactly what you're getting. I'm not trying to pull a fast one. I'm hoping that he did manage to solve it and the car was, you know, basically kind of a roadworthy vehicle for this woman. And I like that the car went to someone that really needed it more than I did. So
yeah,
it might still be in the road. I don't know.
Wow. But the idea that you can take that and you can, that was so, held so many nostalgic moments. It sounds like for you and your mom, especially those trips that you took, that like the idea that you were able to give that to somebody who can now create their own.
Yeah.
Their own
and whose need for it really was more than mine. I mean, I was kind of keeping it going and, you know, but really I didn't need it in a way that, you know, if you've got two young kids, you need to be able to.
You need it.
So,
Wow. What would you say was one of the hardest, I mean, of course, losing your mom and just that initial like awareness of what's happened. I think, you know, death brings a lot of things. My grandma passed away in April. She was 93. And I felt very, very close to her. She's actually the reason why I started the podcast, because her and I had this conversation about, she shared some of her stories of when she was younger, things that she'd gone through, lost babies and things like that. And I had lost some twins when I was younger as well. And so there's like this connection that we felt. And one thing she said, you know, if more of us shared our stories, less of us would feel alone. And I was like, and that's where this idea came, is like, okay, I need to create a space for stories to be told. It doesn't matter what realm we're in. Doesn't matter what the religion or background is. It's just like, just a place to tell stories, to connect people, to bring hope and light. And when she passed, it was like, everybody was, you know, she was older. She'd lived a long life, but just all of these things that come up about, like you say, like the clothing and, what do we do with this and what do we do with that? And all of these, like, even how do you even do a funeral? Like, there's just no one, like, I mean, there's so many steps, like you said, like what happens to the wedding ring? Well, all these things you don't really can't prepare yourself for until you're in that moment, because you don't fully, you don't really understand all the steps that it takes to do something like that. And I've thought about this with friends of ours that lost one of their children a few months back. And, you know, it's just like, how do you go through the process of doing all the things? It's almost like you wish there was a handbook or something that you could like go to that would tell you all of the steps to take, but there's so many different realms and it's different for each person, and there's different attachments and different things that you have to work out. So when you think back to the loss of your mom, is there something that stands out to you that was like, that really, that was the hardest part? That part really surprised me the most.
Oh gosh, it's a good question. I don't think I realized how much it would open up about my past losses. I thought I was kind of like done. I thought I'd like been successful in grieving my father, who had lost in 2016. I didn't realize that, I think I said before, like losing your second parent is more than one plus one. I didn't realize that even at, so I was 42 when I lost my mum, I didn't realize how much I realized not being someone's child anymore would be a kind of a sucker punch to the gut. I didn't realize like how much it would feel like, you know, you feel like you're unprotected, you know, even though you've got your life, your adult life, you know, you're financially sort of solvent, you've got, you know, you are functioning, but there's something about when you lose your second parent, you are, you know, it's a sort of naff term, but like, you know, you're an adult orphan, and there's something that is qualitatively different and is brutal, actually. And I think you're talking about, you know, sharing stories as a way to kind of connect. I think grief can be very isolating. I think it's very difficult, and I say this, and this is true, I think, of other experiences we haven't experienced firsthand. I think it can be very difficult to connect with people that haven't lost a parent. You know, I've got a few friends who both their parents, and they're able to all offer sympathy, but their understanding is a little bit different. And that's not to say, you know, they can be supportive, but in different ways. But I think there's definitely something to be said for trying to close that. You feel isolated, you feel no one understands. That's not really true, but not allowing yourself to be kind of like sort of, don't isolate yourself, if that makes sense, even though that's actually what you maybe sort of feel you want to. So no, I think what really surprised me was sometimes grief isn't over. So, you know, when you lose someone that's close to you, it you're grieving that person, but it's also stirring up a lot of things from the past, and that sense of kind of childhood almost being over, or the people that really cared about you as a child no longer being there. That just, it, your space, your place in the world feels different.
And I think that's, it's really interesting. People can offer you support and from their own understanding, but if you haven't gone through something, it's really hard to know what that person is going through, which you kind of touched on at the beginning. It's like, you wish people could have just been like, I got this for you, and I'm doing this for you, instead of saying, what do you need? I think in the middle of grief and trauma, we don't know what we need. You know, we just need people. We need people to know what we need, because we don't know. People to step in and just bring you that cup of coffee, or bring you that. Right. But well,
I remember very clearly the night that my mother died. So I mean, my mum was, if you can imagine, sort of the family matriarch. And basically, I made the phone call to her eldest brother, and then all of my family were there. And I remember the one thing, and you know, my cousin is very kind of emotionally kind of like intelligent. He is also a psychologist. He's the son of my late aunt. And basically, he just made me dinner. You made me soup. I think, you know, all my uncles were sitting around shell shocked, as you would be. And he found a tin of soup, stuck it on the hob, plopped it on the table, and just said, "Ruth, sit down and have something to eat." And that's a very kind of practical thing. But actually, it was exactly what I needed, because I was like, you know, I was running an empty, and I just needed, you know, it's the cup of tea with the sugar in it. It's that kind of, it's a very kind of visceral being, and actually being fed is incredibly powerful emotionally. I think people bring you food when you're bereaved. It's not just about not having time to cook because you're busy. It's also needing that emotional connection and care. And the number of, you know, kind of friends of my parents that kind of took me for dinner, you know, you've got that kind of combination of the sort of socializing, but just being fed and being fed, you know, being looked after in that very immediate way, it's very powerful. Yeah.
It's like a hug in your belly, yes. You know, almost like that warmth where you just, because sometimes I think when you're in the midst of grief or trauma, you forget to eat. Eating can be something that's completely out of the realm of even on the radar. Yeah. So, and nourishment is so important to help us go through those seasons. Yeah. And it's such a practical thing that I think oftentimes we overlook help people because we overlook that aspect. I remember actually from my grandmother's funeral, this group of elderly ladies made this giant spread for the entire family, and it had like soup and fresh buns and some of these like German things that, you know, that my grandma would have made or we would have enjoyed, and all of the family. And when there's a lot of us, there's probably like 55 of us that were all there. They provided the food for everyone for 2 days. Oh, wow. And like, that was for my aunts, such a huge, like I say, like a huge hug and a gift. Yeah. Just like that lift of that. So I do agree. Food has a way of connecting us and
absolutely.
Yeah. That's a really powerful thing.
Yeah. I like that. I think I've said before, I'm sort of learning Spanish. I love this word in Spanish, which is sobremesa. It's that sort of like, you know, literally kind of on the table. And it's that kind of conversation and the kind of connection you have over a meal. I had my menu del día at a restaurant downtown today. And I think it was 3 courses, but we were there for like 2 hours because the camarero was not in a hurry. And actually it's nice just to be able to take that time and, you know, either get to know people better over a meal or kind of renew those kind of connections. And that's certainly something that, you know, just on a day-to-day level, like cooking for your friends or being cooked for by your friends is really kind of a powerful kind of sort of reinforcement. Mm-hmm. But I think in times when you're feeling emotionally vulnerable or raw, they sort of it takes an extra significance.
Yeah, totally. I was actually, when we were in Barcelona, I was looking at places to eat and looking up just different kind of experiences like you do when you're in new places. And there's this like movement, I think, that I don't know how you'd want to call it, but it started in New York actually, that I read about while I was there. And it's this idea of creating a space for people to come and have a beautiful dinner at like a long table, a family style dinner. And they just sell tickets. They get like a musician and a chef to come in and make this meal. And the idea is like getting back to the table with being with people. And so there's actually a lady in Barcelona that does the same thing. She hosts these dinners, and there wasn't any that were happening while I was there, but I can find the information. But it's like in this old home. I think it's one of original, like a Gaudi, like it was a one of his places that he had designed. And it's very raw. It's just like a long table and a little musician in the corner, and the idea was like they call it the secret dinners, and it's just about getting people around table to enjoy a meal and the power of a meal
and getting to know each other
it does something, like being in a space where you food does it's a great place to connect and create this organic conversations to flow. If you didn't have food, you'd just be sitting around a table looking at each other.
And there's something kind of I don't know if primal is the right word, in a way that even like having a drink with people is different. Something about eating together that's really, I suppose, if you go back to some biblical times, to do the Last Supper, that kind of way of to kind of connect. Because I guess in a kind of a basic way, you're letting your guard down. You're totally relaxed when you're eating. You're not about to sort of take up arms and like, you know, go and fight the enemy. You're kind of you're breaking bread with someone. You're kind of you trust this person enough that you will kind of put down your arms and eat together. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's powerful and it's meant to be. Mm-hmm. It's like this beautiful space. If you were to tell somebody who is maybe going through what you've gone through, Is there something that you would want them to know?
Your feelings will change. It will get easier. Don't be frustrated if it takes longer than you think it should do. I think because there is a kind of a societal kind of like, so just a fear of death, I think, is a sort of shame of sort of speaking about it, about being open about it. Even when you are grieving, sometimes you feel that you're on a kind of like a sort of a timeline and that you should be feeling better or you should be over it. I would say it probably took almost 2 years to feel like myself again. And, you know, so we're really talking kind of in the last sort of like, you know, this year. And that surprised me. And it eventually I gave myself permission just to sort of feel how I was feeling. And that goes also to kind of how you might feel better on a certain day. And like, if you're having a good day and then you feel guilty because you're not like kind of grieving or you're not actively thinking about it. So basically there's no bad feeling. Allow yourself to, you know, and sometimes the feeling will, it feels more like the feeling is kind of going through you rather than you're having the feeling. You're kind of a kind of an, you're not the subject in this kind of relationship, you're the object. So, and the feelings will be kind of like messy and probably like maybe even sort of shameful, and you might feel angry disproportionately. Like, that's all fine. It's just, you know, it's part of the process. And it will change, and it will, you won't always, the suffering will diminish, if that makes sense. But I would also say something about, there's definitely a kind of a vibrancy to grief that we don't talk about, the sense of you do have a kind of a carpe diem thing. You can, everything is so kind of like raw that the good things feel more kind of like alive as well. And you feel kind of like imbued with this sort of sense of like, I'm going to go out and take action, and like, you know, time is fleeting and kind of, and I really wish that that's something that you could bottle. Because that feeds as well, and that's part of, I think, of kind of coming to terms with it. So I'd say just, yeah, there's no wrong feelings, there's no bad feelings, but things will soften in time. So I suppose kind of take courage and let people help you. And that, I think, asking for help. You know, I had a house to clear and I couldn't do it on my own, so I had to ask, especially once I sold my car, you know, I had to ask people for help, like, can you help me take it to the dump? And pushing past my resistance, because I'm quite independent. So yeah, if feel the feelings, and if people want to help you, let them, because it's your gift to them as well, because people want to help.
That's a good way of looking at it. People don't know how to help, but like giving them that space, that's it. It gives something to them as well, giving something to you.
Exactly.
Wow. As we come to kind of the close, is there anything that comes to mind that you're like, I would want someone to know, whether it be the person who's nurturing someone who's grieving somebody's loss, or whether it's a person who is actually grieving the loss, in the midst of loss, both your parents. So I imagine, like you said, it's like, it's such different feelings, because one is, has a different kind of finality to it than losing your dad. Your mom can still hold all of those moments and memories, you can reminisce together. So death, it feels, and I imagine it's different depending on who it is and the layers of what that looks like. And in your case, having both your parents pass. Is there something that comes to mind?
I think sometimes, so going back to this idea of, you know, if you don't have the background of, you know, having lost someone yourself, I think there's a lot of anxiety about saying or doing the wrong thing. And I suppose for someone that's wanting to support someone who's grieving, is it probably doesn't matter too much. You know, I know some people don't like small talk. My view of small talk has always been what you say, talk about the weather. It doesn't matter. Like, that's just sort of surface level stuff to basically say, I want to connect with you, and I value, you know, your time to actually have that connection. If you like, the kind of the words are not important. I think the same is true when you're supporting someone who's grieving, is unless you say something really stupid like, oh, you know, your mother was a terrible person and you must be glad to get rid of her. I don't know. Although maybe in some circumstances that might be appropriate. You know, really, like, you're holding space for someone. Actually, probably most of the time, allowing the other person to speak is really what's valuable. You know, The only thing you can do wrong is to basically hide. I've seen, not so much myself, but I've seen people that kind of retreat because they're uncomfortable, because maybe it raises feelings for them. They retreat, they don't return phone calls, they kind of, you know, I have had a few people that sort of text me saying, oh, how are you doing? And they don't mention the D word. It's like, I'm thinking about mother's death all the time. If you say death, passed away, dying, like, you're not going to upset me because I'm already in that space.
Hmm.
You know, don't tiptoe around it. You know, sometimes, you know, if I've had a colleague or someone I know who's lost a parent, I'm terrible. I kind of rip off the band-aid, and the first day I see them, I say, I'm so sorry for the death of your loved one. Because, but that's my personality. So, I'd say just as long as you do something, you're not doing the wrong thing. You know, you hold space, you listen some more. You know, you offer them something kind of like concrete that you can do. Just don't run away. Yeah. And maybe that you could say that's the same in terms of your own self-help is don't. My mother did have a mantra, which I think sometimes was good and sometimes was not, which was. Repress and distract. So that was what she did. She tended not to think about things, particularly in relation to losing my father and how much she missed him, and she distracts herself. Sometimes the feelings will find you, and sometimes actually you can't run from them, and they have to be felt, and that's okay as well. So I just say, don't run away, because things will always catch up to you.
Yeah. And it sounds like even with your mom, like repress and distract, it sounds like maybe that was part of it. But then, like you said, finding all those the poetry that she wrote, there was a part of her that was like, I'm feeling this, you know? Exactly. And even though she didn't share it, she felt it.
Yeah. And you know, to be fair to him, we did also have those conversations where, you know, I'd someone say, you know, gosh, I really miss dad. She'd be like, yeah, I really miss dad. Or, you know, we'd find ways to sort of talk about it. So I think it was more just how she kind of got by during the day. But I think, and there's something about, like, there's that kind of time late in the evening where you've spent all your day just running away from your feelings and trying to, you know, whether it's sort of like saving face at work, and there comes a point where you're on your own with you and your emotions, and there is nowhere to go, and that's where you kind of, you know, the rubber hits the road in terms of allowing yourself to kind of go through it. So you're right. I mean, I think my mum found her own way, which gives me some comfort.
Yeah, that there was an outlet, you know, like giving yourself an outlet, whether it be talking with people, or whether it be writing, or maybe it's speaking, recording yourself, whatever. There's so many different ways to kind of have that outlet.
And also, I mean, and maybe it's from my background of, you know, in addition to my dad and my cousin, I've got a lot of psychologists in the family. Therapy is wonderful. That might be sort of therapeutic journaling. It could be speaking to someone. I think there's a huge amount to be said for someone who isn't a blood relative or a friend holding space for you, and maybe reflecting back some ways or modes of thinking that aren't serving you. So I'm a huge kind of proponent of therapy where it's helpful. So
100%. Yeah. There's a lot that we don't navigate on our own that a therapist can guide us through gently, that
for sure,
that can bring such closure and healing. As we come to the close, I wonder if there's something that comes to your mind, because I think there's so many things we do talk in life, like, you know, traveling, there's a lot of like surface level things we can talk about, but one thing I've noticed, and my grandma and I talked about this, my grandma was one of the most joyful people. Like my grandpa passed, and she was, I think he passed maybe 8 or 10 years before she did, and she just said, like, I know that, you know, he would want me to have a good time. And so she, every day she'd get up, she put on her lipstick, she put on her eyebrow, like draw her eyebrows in, she put her high heels on. And she was like, I just laugh. Like, I find a reason to laugh about anything. She's like, sometimes I feel like I'm a schoolgirl because I'm giddy. Like, I'm so giddy. And it really taught me that joy is like, it's something, it's so contagious. And every time we'd be with my grandma, she would be silly. She'd take out her teeth, or she'd do something random and crazy and be silly. And it's just contagious. I think it's something we don't talk about, though. Like, what's bringing people joy? So as we close, I always love to ask the question, is there something in life right now that is bringing you joy?
Gosh. There's a lot of things. One thing is walking into a bookstore and just looking at the shelves. I know that's a really small thing, but I've found so many good bookstores in Barcelona, both Spanish language bookstores where there's teeny tiny English language section, or like there's a couple of like really good sort of English language bookstores. There's libraries. It's that sense of possibility. I like having options. So I've got a lot of books in my bookshelves, which the books have not yet been read or they're kind of in the middle. And there's something very joyful about walking into a bookstore and kind of going, right, what book am I going to pick up today? And it's a very small thing, but it probably gives me a disproportionate sense of joy, but I love it. I just love that. And I think maybe it's tied in with having more leisure time here. And that sense where I live, there's a beautiful sort of like kind of gardens nearby. And once the heat's kind of died in for the day, I can take my book and sit there and have an hour. And that is joy for me.
Yeah, that is. There's nothing quite like a book. I think even just cracking open a book and like the smell of a book, there's something just like.
Yeah. Forget the Kindle. Yeah.
It's gonna be exactly. Put the Kindle aside. Exactly. The old school is the best. I love that. I think we don't usually travel with a lot of, I mean, as you know, I don't usually take a lot of books, especially when you have limited space, but we're in the England for the next 3 months. And so we've been finding bookstores and the one thing my kids have said is like, oh, holding a book again just feels so good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And basically I'm buying all these secondhand books in the hope that they'll all get read before I leave. And then I'll donate them all to a secondhand bookstore. And that will give me a kind of a deadline for actually getting through them. But these are books I could download, you know, on my tablet anytime, but it's not the same. So.
No, it's not the same. No, I totally agree. I love that. That's a little great little joy pocket. Something you can look forward to at the end of your day in your little courtyard area. Yeah, I love that. Well, I am so delighted that you were here and to share your story. I think death is a hard thing to talk about, and there's not a lot of distance between when your mom passed and where we are today. So I can imagine there's just even the idea of sharing it brings up a lot of feelings and emotion. And I am so grateful that you're here and that you took the time, that you felt like you could go there with us and Naked with the community here and share your story. And I know that people that are going through something like this will find a lot of comfort just knowing somebody else is on the other, you know, gone through it and still here and finding joy, you know, and traveling and doing the things and still feeling all the emotions that come with the process. And like you say, it gets easier, but I'm imagine some days are harder than others and some days are easier than others. Yeah. It's a fold of both. Well,
and thank you for holding space, Janelle. It's been wonderful to speak to you.
No, it's been such a delight. I really, really do treasure our time together and very grateful. So thank you so much. You. If I come back to Glasgow, I will come find you.
Yeah, look me up for sure. And hopefully we may have a period of good weather. You never know.
Yeah. That would be amazing. Well, have an amazing rest of your time in Barcelona.
Thank you.
It sounds like you're in a great adventure and keep doing the thing that brings you joy. Keep finding books.
Thank you very much. I'll try to do my best.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
Ciao. Thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcast goodness. This way you'll never miss out on any future episodes, plus it really helps us. And if you want to share your favorite episode with a friend, that would be absolutely incredible. This goes a long way. If you'd like to join Naked by sharing part of your story, just leave us a message on Instagram or email us at nakedwithjanelle@gmail.com. Also, a big thanks to my son, Mikkel, who is the best cheerleader and maybe one of the biggest believers in Naked, and also produces and edits all our podcasts. I am beyond grateful for him and very aware that I couldn't do this on my own. Thank you so much for tuning in and for being